I knew I wanted Mediterranean, and I knew what my budget was, which was for that trip, I had $3,000 to spend for the month, for a month of lodging. I ended up spending like $3,800, but I wanted to stick to $3,000. So I basically looked $3,000 a month. I looked at the Airbnb Explore map and kind of looked for little patches to see if anything could possibly be within that budget. And that's how we ended up in Béziers, because Languedoc sort of popped up as a region where you could rent something for that price. And so I kind of then started going down the rabbit hole of what's this place like? And it was great.
Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This week, we welcome Dia. Gosh, do we call you Dia the Deal Mommy? Do we call you just Dia Adams? Do we call you the Disney Savant? Welcome to the show, Dia. And how do you want us to kind of refer to you? Because you've just got such a wide variety of experience.
Thanks for having me. And thanks for that intro down memory lane. Dia is fine. But it's funny that you mentioned that, because I just this week got a Facebook memory that my first family travel for real life was 10 years ago this week.
Wow. I remember those events. I had the chance to go to the one you had in, was it Reston or Tyson's Corner?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny you bring that up, because you actually inspired me. You, and as well as Matt Haig with the Saverosity Dues, were both inspirations for me doing the reselling dues that we did 5-10 years ago as well. The conversations we had, you made it sound like hosting an event was so much more accessible. And I just really appreciate the fact that you demystified that part. I mean, that's not really a miles and points thing, right? It's just the fact that some of these events are just so valuable in getting together with people, and to understand that they're actually achievable. You don't have to have like a degree in event management was an important lesson for me to learn.
What I found more interesting is how much more valuable I found the groups of 50, 60 to be than going to, say, like an FTU or like, I love Chicago seminars, but at this point, I'm going just more to see people and say hi. I'm not really expecting to like learn as much. But when you're in these smaller groups, I always walked away from those with something that I had never even thought of.
That's a really interesting observation. You know, there does seem to be this kind of critical mass around, you know, certain numbers of people where, you know, it's large enough that you can mingle and you can introduce yourself to a lot of people, but it's not so large that it's daunting where you can't even meet like half the people. So you're right. I think some of these larger conferences that are 500 people, 1,000 people, 2,000 people, it's almost too much for your average person to be able to actually interact with the vast majority of people, where you're right. Some of the smaller gatherings in that kind of sweet spot of 50 to 60, it's very easy to meet everybody.
That said, if you are coming to Chicago seminars, feel free to come say hi. I will be there this year. Yeah. And I think that's why, like, you guys doing the happy hours that you've done, and the one you've done for Toys for Tots for so long, those sorts of events I also find really valuable. And I know for me, like, when I was first starting out, it was just the mere fact that I found other people that thought the way that I did about things, because it can get so isolating when you're like the, you know, crazy one of your friends. And I mean, that's how the blog all started, was that I just kept saying the same stories over and over again. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to write all this down, not expecting anyone would ever read it. Yeah. So having that, just any sense of community that you can find, I think is absolutely huge.
It's so important to find your tribe. I know that we found the same thing. I mean, now we've shared on the pod, you know, Tom and I met at one of the FTUs, but finding that tribe, finding just that collection of people that understand you, that you can bounce ideas off of, that if you just, you know, bounce them off of, you know, a random coworker, or, you know, you call it a civilian, like somebody that's not in the game, they just look at you like, what? you're talking about, like, you're talking about a 0.5% or a 1% spread, like, huh? So you're going to fly from DC to New York to be able to fly then to Madrid, but really you want to get to Hong Kong, and you actually are embracing this circuitous path.
Yeah.
They're just going to think you're completely crazy. Yeah.
I mean, and for me, it was even more, much more basic than that. It was just like, oh, what are you doing this summer? Oh, we're renting a house in the Outer Banks for a week. What are you doing this summer? Oh, I'm spending the summer in Europe. Me knowing that spending a summer in Europe is cheaper than renting a house in the Outer Banks for a week. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So yeah, so there'd just always be sort of this disconnect, and you kind of see people's eyes pop open wondering if you're a trust fund baby and thinking, why, you know, why on earth do you live where you live or whatever? And, you know, just having that sort of disconnect. And then so having people that do understand when you, you know, take a cruise to Norway for free with your friends, or when you spend, like I said, spend, you know, what, four summers in Europe. It just is much easier to have those conversations with people that understand what you're doing.
And such great points there. And we can jump off just based on like that one little, like couple of sentences, we can jump like five different places on our kind of agenda for this. But I want to kind of go and dive a little bit more into sort of a column that you have now. You are writing for Fortune.
Forbes.
No, Fortune. I used to write for Forbes, now I write for Fortune.
Okay. Well, then I'm wrong. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Keep up. I guess we can see someone read the show notes.
It's in there too.
They're both there. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you're writing essentially what's in Dia's wallet, which for me reminds me a lot of Richard Kerr back when he was at the Points Guy, his critical points article or series of articles. The way I read it is don't go with the common things. I think your most recent one, or maybe it was one prior, was sort of saying something like, people go to the same 10 or 20 destinations worldwide, and you've got to break free of that.
Yep. Destination dupes. Yep.
What was it that kind of inspired you to take that approach with this series, number one, and what's driving your thinking there?
Well, I'm in a really fortunate position. I'm the senior editor for Credit Cards. So what comes out of Fortune Recommends is basically mine. So I'm sort of really having to think about who I want to talk to and what I want to say. And the What's in Dia's Wallet series is basically meant for sort of those people that have miles and points, but haven't really spent the time to think about exactly what they want to do, or they know what they want to do and they don't really know how to get there, and kind of connecting the dots. And also, I think the column is sort of a permission slip. Like every article I write, like the next one I'm going to write is how I'm getting something like, I don't know, 8 cents per Hilton point or some ridiculous amount to stay at a Home 2 Suites off of 95 for Aiden's graduation, because it's Virginia Tech graduation weekend and a 2-night stay is like $1,600 or 30,000 Hilton points or something. So talking about sort of those things that people maybe don't think about, or talking about, for instance, how I think that choice points transferred from Autograph and Citi is like a ridiculously good deal that I don't think enough people talk about. Or that I think Copa, for instance, 25,000 airplane miles in business on Copa, pretty much anywhere, Central or South America. I mean, it's crazy. So I think that's sort of my goal, is to kind of just open up subjects. I mean, honestly, that of what's in my wallet, what's in my mind, The things I've talked about before. Sometimes I feel like we settle on a value for points. And I mean, some of that is done by, you know, testing. I think Frequent Miler does some good testing. TPG, I always feel like it's a little bit high, but they do some testing. But it doesn't really matter to me. Because what matters to me is how I'm getting value out of those points. So like for me, a lot of people value American Express points, what, like 1.82 cents. I value them about 1.3 to 1.5, because that's where most of my transfers are to Flying Blue. So unless there's a transfer bonus, that's about what I'm getting for those. I value my Citi and Autograph points much higher, because I'm getting 2-to-1 to choice for those. So it's basically the conversations are just, sort of, I just want people to think a little bit, be a little bit more, I don't know if you're following this TikTok trend, a little more mindful, a little more demure about their miles choices. And just knowing that it's okay. That's basically what I'm going to say.
It makes me wonder if that's kind of some of the evolution of this hobby that we all have. You know, that when we first started, it's this small niche. You know, you're the small group of people. And it has grown. I think the totality of the people playing the game is so much larger. So you I think run into this groupthink a lot more easily than you might have in the past, because suddenly there's just a few voices that seem to get parroted all over the place. And then on top of that, you have people gravitating toward kind of some of the same techniques. You know, everyone's using the same tools, and it's some parts have gotten easier. And so what you have is you kind of have a little bit of a distortion where certain things, very popular, going to the Maldives, you know, like doing this, going to this Park Hyatt or that Park Hyatt. There's certain things where everybody's chasing the same thing, but then there's this whole other world of things that people just, an influencer hasn't picked up on it yet. Or it's not popular because it's just more utilitarian. Just like you said, going to graduation and having points as a way to do that and not have to break the bank. You know, for some of these very peak kind of situations, people just sometimes forget about these things. And it's great that you're providing, because, you know, honestly, a lot of times the inspiration that people are seeing right now are the Instagram inspirations, but not kind of the practical inspirations of here are things that actually provide value to me that people can do, because maybe they are a little less sexy, but very much just as valuable and as, you know, interesting as maybe something that somebody you're seeing on Instagram or Twitter or something.
And not everything has to be about Vendoming whenever you redeem your points.
Yeah, exactly.
I was wondering who was going to say it first. Well, I mean, I know that there's such a tremendous Hyatt bias. I know there's a Hyatt bias in this room. But oh, honestly, day after day, the program I keep returning to is IHG. I mean, when I can find choice, I kind of think of choices like TJ Maxx. Like, I can't be guaranteed I'm going to find what I want at Choice, but it's going to be a really good deal if I do. But if I need to go to Target, then that's IHG for me. Because with that fourth night free, I will never give up the Premier card.
What's Hyatt? Is that Saks? Is that Bloomingdale's? What is it?
IHG, I guess, would be like Macy's. Macy's? Intercontinental, okay. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
That's Bloomingdale's.
You could call some Intercontinental Saks, maybe, but not okay. Definitely okay. Not But yeah, with that fourth night free, I mean, I will never give that up. And I get so much value out of that program. They do that, or they'll just do sales sometimes where something will be 15% off even for one night. And you can always get IHG points for a half cent. So I find so much value with that program.
You know, I miss their gamification, you know, like for a long time there, they were doing a lot of gamification with that program, and they were doing such interesting and fun things, but I feel like they kind of pulled back on that, I guess, more recently.
Yeah, but it's still, like I said, when you can always buy points for a half cent, it's so easy to get them.
It's easy to acquire. Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's such a blind spot, IHG. I mean, I've used them a handful of times. I was really surprised. So Tom had introduced us to the value that Choice has in the Nordics. I know that Sam and Robert talked on, so Sam just recently did a trip to Norway, and just the incredible amount of value that he was getting out of some of these Choice hotels. I think Strawberry is one of the brands. I mean, these are not Econo Lodges or the Choice hotels that we know in anything but love. These are actually legitimate, wonderful properties that it sounds like in the Nordics. And with that transfer ratio, it just opens up a whole nother part of the part of the continent, I should say.
Yeah, and that's always been my issue with Hyatt. I mean, they've been dabbling into these new chains, but there are still just entire swaths of the planet that they just don't cover.
It's so true. And I find myself now, we're in this kind of phase where we're not traveling as much as we used to travel. And so sometimes we just want comfort. You know, you want that city that you can roll out of bed and you know where you're going to go for lunch, or you're going to be able to, you know, you know the different things that you want to do. And you want that bed that's going to be that comfortable duvet that you know is going to be at a Thompson or at a Grand Hyatt or a Park Hyatt. And so we definitely have felt somewhat limited lately as we sort of go and sort of navigate this sort of different up-tempo of our travel. And it's really hard to kind of force ourselves to get out of that sort of preference. But, you know, it just continues to be a shift for us. But knowing that they've got some of these nicer hotels and IHG and stuff, like I've never stayed at I only stayed at an Intercontinental for the first time in June. And that was at MSP. Great hotel, great airport. The bridge that they advertise that allows you to get airside is not open.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Talk about a little bit of a sad one. So before we jump into the main topic of the show, though, I did drop, you know, another term that you're well known for. I would say you're well known for, Vendoming. But I don't think we really talked too much in specifics of kind of how you came about that term and perhaps how it's taken a little bit of a life of its own.
Well, it's funny though, because if I think about it too hard, almost every success I've ever had in my career has been due to a rant. and FT4RL was for a rant. My blog going viral was a rant. And basically, it was born of a rant. It got very, especially, you have to remember a decade ago, and you weren't paying attention because you didn't need to, you didn't have kids yet. But a decade ago, or even when I started, the kids were, 4 and 7, and they're now 17 and 20. There was basically summer, and that was it. There was mommy points. That was literally the only voice talking about travel, family at all. And Summer and I are actually friends. But at the time, I was getting frustrated because when you have only one person talking about family travel, then you're just not getting a diversity of voices. And there was a review of the Vendome from the perspective of families. And I was sitting there with two kids, and I'd been to Chicago seminars, and there was a talk. And actually, it was funny because it was pizza. It was pizza in Summer. I love pizza. I respect what they were saying. But I came away from the talk thinking you needed a million miles to get a family of four to Paris for a week. And I'm like, that's crazy. You can absolutely get a family of four for Paris for a week for less than a million miles. And it was this, everywhere I was looking, it was the TPG, and everyone was just talking about the Vendome. And it just sort of became this shorthand for me for like consumption for the sake of consumption. Not really thinking about your audience, because there are, you know, so many people that a million miles sounds like just a crazy abstraction that you can't even visualize, when there are so many other ways that you can travel, you know, that it's okay to fly coach, that it's okay to stay in a
cover your ears, time Trevor,
or
cover
Airbnb
your ears.
Or whatever. Oh, I'm so sorry. Have I offended you?
This might trigger Trevor. You know, he needs to take a sip of champagne.
But that's how Vendoming came about, is that it was just that there was really no one else talking about families. And also at the time, I remember Summer only had one kid. And when she had two kids, things also changed for her. But she was kind of in the same place where you are. And there are things that you can do with a two-year-old with one kid that you can't do with a 6 and a 9-year-old. Yep. And, you know, with two kids. And then if you, God forbid, you have three kids, then it's a whole different conversation. But that's sort of where it all came about. It's just, you know, like I just sort of had a post. I wrote a post one day on DLMami saying, does anyone else feel this? And the response was like overwhelming. And that's how we ended up with the conference that went on for, you know, 6 sessions. And that's sort of how it all just sort of kind of snowballed from there.
Sorry, I'm still getting over the flying across an ocean in coach. So let's tease that out a little bit more, right? So you figured out a way to travel more and to travel with a family of four to get places like Europe, like Asia, like South America. And you've shared this story probably more times than I can remember, but I'm probably going to get it a little bit wrong. But the thing that just jumped out at me with this concept of Camp Mom, and we'll give you a chance to kind of explain the synthesis of it, but the experience that really just makes me want to strive for that when our daughter is a little bit older, or my daughter's a little bit older, I should say, is after a summer of Camp Mom, I think Deal Girl, your daughter, went to school and the teacher asked each of the students, oh, what did you do this summer? So your daughter says, oh, well, I slept in this beautiful castle and we went to here and we went to there. And you had a parent-teacher conference sometime after, and the teacher says, your daughter just has such an incredible imagination. She said that she stayed in a castle over the summer.
Yeah, and that she saw fireworks over the Eiffel Tower, and yeah.
It must have been an amazing feeling to be able to respond to her.
It was, and it just made me laugh. And I was like, yes, thank you very much. She does have a great imagination. But she, you know, at this point, really was just having a good memory, because that all happened. And it was, you know, one of those moments like, you know, what are you doing here? But yeah, and it was basically what happened. And that was really the first, what I would call, Camp Mom that we did. She was 6 and Aiden was 9. And I realized that once we got to where we were going, staying there cost less than putting two kids in a day camp would cost. I mean, living, as you know, in the DC metro area, and even a decade ago, I couldn't really find a decent day camp for under $400 a week. And now I would say it's probably $500. And I knew I didn't want the kids at home all day, every day. But I also knew that the idea of spending that much money, I could use it a lot more effectively. So supplementing with miles and points, what we would do, the sort of the camp mom, as it worked, is at the time I was freelancing, and then for later ones, I was working, but I was working fully remote. And my husband works for the federal government, so he's more kind of tied to a schedule. So what would happen is all four of us would go somewhere. The first one, all four of us went to Ireland. And we spent 2 weeks in Ireland, and then he went home. And then I would take the kids for 4 to 6 weeks after that, and we would explore Europe, and I would set myself a budget of $800 a week, plus whatever I could use on miles and points. And, you know, with some flexible arrangements and accommodations and sort of taking advantage of opportunities that I, if I saw something, you know, interesting as a last minute timeshare rental, that's how we ended up in a castle. It was actually a timeshare rental. Or if I was able to, like, I knew I could redeem for the Etoile, which has that amazing view, which, by the way, I know people love the Vendôme, but if you could do the Etoile on Bastille Day, it's the best view in Paris because it's the highest hotel in Paris. And you have, make sure you have to get a tower room because they actually at first upgraded us into a suite, but it didn't face the tower. So I actually negotiated to get a tower room for an hour so I can, we can watch the fireworks. But that's like, it's literally the best view I've ever, I mean, the fireworks were insane. As you just saw at the Olympics, they know how to put on a show. But I knew I had that budget and I knew enough about miles and points that I probably had maybe 100,000. If I spent 100,000 points in the 6 weeks, I'd be surprised. But the 100,000 plus my, and I didn't even spend $800 every week, but that was sort of like my, the upper end of my budget. But I would, you know, at that time, especially when you're flying inside Europe, there's really no reason to fly business class inside Europe. That just honestly makes no sense to me. You're getting an empty seat. Who cares? You know, it's a 2 hour flight. Or we were using the trains. And then our lodging was a combination of either redeeming points or doing, you know, like creative vacation rentals. Last year, we did 8 weeks in Europe. And first, we did a free cruise. We did a med cruise. We did 5 weeks of house sitting in England. And then we did a week in Basel, Switzerland. And so the lodging for all of that was literally free. And we really only had to pay to get ourselves from Rome to England to Basel and then our flights there. And so, you know, and when I wouldn't count food because we would buy food at home. So as if I was doing groceries, I would still be buying groceries. But that's sort of how it came about. And it was amazing how far I could stretch $800 a week.
I can only imagine. In Europe alone, as long as you can figure out the hotel or the lodging, I mean, the food is largely cheaper. At least it feels like. I mean, you know, you eat a decent bottle of wine for under 10 euro.
Yeah.
Let alone, you know, the food, as long as you're not going to, you know, a white linen tablecloth place. So how did you sort of map out these sorts of trips? Did you incorporate particular experiences that you wanted the kids to have? Did you include them in the planning early on, or sort of how did that evolve over time?
I did include them in the planning at a level. For instance, the first reason we did Ireland before Aiden's 10th birthday was because he was born in Ireland. So we wanted to take him to see where he was born. When we went to Japan, he chose Japan, and it was because at the time his two loves in life were baseball and anime. I'm like, okay, we got to go to Japan. So that's how we ended up in Asia for that one. And then sometimes I would kind of do that. Like if you've ever seen like a show like The Property Brothers or something, they do this trick where they lay out three options and they let someone choose one so that they think that they're in charge. So I would do stuff like that. Like I would show like with how we ended up with the South America trip was I showed them a picture of Iguazu Falls and they're like, oh, well, we have to go there. And usually I would ask each kid for like one thing they really wanted to do. And so like Ari really wanted to see fireworks. And then once I figured out I could do fireworks in Paris, then it was sort of that I was able to kind of put that together. When we went to Japan, Aiden really wanted to go to a baseball game. So we went to a baseball game. And sometimes, I mean, we have to get a little creative about how we make it work. And sometimes it's hotels. I mean, like when we did, I think Asia was entirely hotels. Just because it's a little bit trickier to know about, you know, you can rent Airbnbs and stuff, of course, over there. But I wanted, especially traveling by myself, I wanted more consistency with the kids in Asia. I just wanted, you know, I wanted that back. And it, actually, I'm glad I had it because we were staying at the Hyatt in Da Nang and Ari got sick. And because I was at the hotel, the concierge was able to get me a doctor and get everyone, you know, together. And if I'd been an Airbnb, that would have been a lot more stressful. But yeah, I mean, sometimes it's, I you know how it is when you're browsing award deal websites just for fun on a Saturday night, because that's what we do. I love browsing things like Sky.
Guilty.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very guilty.
Very guilty. I do that, but I do that for things like Sky Auction. I love Sky Auction. Last minute timeshare rentals. It's like the day old bread of timeshare rentals. I love it. So, you know, some of the times it's that. It's sometimes like, oh, wow, you know, or like that's how I ended up in the Canary Islands the first time was that I saw there was a $300 week in Tenerife the week that I had free to travel. And I'm like, I knew nothing about the Canary Islands, did some Googling, and I was like, oh, that looks pretty nice. And that's how I ended up in the Canary Islands. So sometimes it's that. That's how I ended up in Béziers in France, was I knew I wanted Mediterranean and I knew what my budget was, which was for that trip, I had $3,000 to spend for the month, for a month of lodging. I ended up spending like $3,800, but I wanted to stick to $3,000. So I basically looked $3,000 a month. I looked at the Airbnb Explore map and kind of looked for little patches to see if anything could possibly be within that budget. And that's how we ended up in Béziers, because Languedoc sort of popped up as a region where you could rent something for that price. And so I kind of then started going down the rabbit hole of what's this place like? And it was great.
I love it. You're giving people permission to stay somewhere other than Hyatt.
Yes, so. I am. And I'm also giving you permission to stay at Hyatt if you really want to.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, making it a combination. You know, I mean, yeah. I definitely like splurging occasionally, you know, or maybe spending a night or two at a Park Hyatt. And then I've got my taste of luxury and I can be a little bit more practical for the rest of the trip and focus on some other things. Because, you know, sometimes it is nice to have a luxurious breakfast and, you know, 1,000 thread count sheets and things like that. But I don't need it every day. I can live a little bit more modestly, especially if I'm getting better value or if I'm able to extend my trip and really kind of enjoy the place and not be in such a rush. You know, I think the other thing we've had other guests on, and one of the things that kind of sat with me is kind of people advising about the pace of travel. Because I think what a lot of people do is they try to get everything in and say, oh, I've only got 3 days in this place. I got to see everything. And, you know, the reality is most of these places aren't going anywhere. And the other thing is, if you can kind of arrange your trip to be more immersive, to be more present, to have more time to enjoy the European lifestyle, for that matter. You know, I mean, that's kind of what people are always in love with anyway, you know, it's being able to sit people watch at the cafe with a glass of wine and enjoy, you know, some nice weather and some wonderful environment, but perhaps even some great, great cuisine and culture. How do you do that if you don't dedicate the time to it? And sometimes, you know, if you're doing that always in a 5-star American branded hotel, you're taken away from that experience as well sometimes, you know, because, you know, not every Park Hyatt is really integrating the culture, the environment. We were in the Istanbul Park Hyatt, for instance, and, you know, it felt like a Park Hyatt that could be anywhere, at least in some of them, in my room, at least. And the reality is that some of these, you know, Marriott hotels or whatever hotels, you know, they're just going to have kind of standard decor, standard culture, standard cuisine, because that's what people expect. That's what you're paying money for. What Trevor mentioned, which is, you know, being able to have that consistency and the standard that you're used to. But then on the flip side, you also are going to the destination to be somewhere else. So embrace that. And I think probably the best way to do that is look at for these other options that you're not going to see on Instagram and not going to see on the Point Sky website. You know, you're going to have to search for them. Sky Auction, you're reminding me of some. I've used Sky Auction. I've done stuff on there, but I had forgotten about it. You know, sometimes the things that you know, you forget because you get out of practice. You know, I'm going to blame the pandemic because, you know, that also made me rusty on a lot of things. But that's just some great advice. And it's something that is so wonderful to hear. And I think people need to hear it because I think people are consuming a lot of stuff in the Miles and Points community. I'm not hearing this message enough, I think.
I couldn't agree more. And kind of speaking to that, to your point, when we had that apartment in France, in Saint Raphael, it forced us to go out to the cafe because we otherwise we weren't going to get breakfast. And we had a better breakfast. I mean, it didn't cost a ton, but I mean, you get yourself a freshly made croissant, a baguette, you sit on the beach and you just enjoy your breakfast. And it's a completely different experience than kind of rolling out of bed, throwing some clothes on and going down to the buffet at the Hyatt Regency, you know, just up the road in Nice. And so I don't think one style is right. I think trying to adapt your travel style based on the kind of trip that you're taking, the kind of experience that you want to take, you're not going to be able to maintain that Hyatt-only strategy, and you might not even be able to maintain your preferred hotel chain, even if it's not Hyatt, as you get to the tertiary, or I don't know what fourth or fifthiary, quinciary type cities. As you want to get to some of these other cities, you're just going to have to find either a rental or you're going to have to find whatever that IHG Holiday Inn that might be on the rim of the city. And then you're kind of trenching your way in. That was kind of our experience in Genoa and in Parma. In reality, in Parma, as we talked in that previous episode, I should have just gotten a short-term rental. I would have had a much better experience than trying to shoehorn in to a hotel because I wanted to be in a hotel.
And also, once you're three people in a European hotel room, it's just, not comfortable.
If they even let you.
It also depends. It's sort of the question that I've learned to ask myself after all these years is, how do I want to feel? And sometimes I want to feel pampered. You know what I mean? There are times where that, you know, I've been stressed out or whatever, and going somewhere and having someone wait on me is my priority. And so if that's the case, then I plan a trip around luxury. And I think about that. And I fly business class and I stay at an Intercontinental, or maybe I guest of honor a Hyatt. You know, or I think about if that's what I want, or like the Waldorf Astoria. We did the Waldorf Astoria in Rome, which the location is terrible, but the hotel is lovely.
I would imagine the view is really good.
Yeah, the view is fantastic, but it's like 20 years to get into the city. So it's not a great location for exploring. The pool's nice too. So if you want that, sometimes you want that, and that's okay. Sometimes I want to feel like I've explored something. Sometimes I want to feel like I've learned something. Sometimes I want to sit on a beach, you know, and it's like, okay, I want to sit on a beach. Do I need to have a luxury hotel room to sit on a beach? Not necessarily. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is my priority? Maybe I want to go to Disneyland Paris. Do I need to stay at a fancy hotel to go to Disneyland Paris? No, I'm in my room from midnight to 8 a.m. Who cares? As long as there's a comfortable bed. So I tend to base trips on a vibe these days. Like, how do I want to feel during this trip? Everything else kind of goes from that.
Great points. So as we sort of pivot a little bit with these camp moms, clearly your kids had to have learned something about travel hacking. I mean, if not learning from that, it's got to be in the genes. So how have you, I suppose, number one, cultivated that? You know, I think you mentioned that your kids are a senior in high school and now senior in college. So clearly they're at the age where they're starting to think about credit cards. They're starting to think about travel and sort of what they want to do, what their style is. How did you cultivate that? And what are the ramifications of it?
It's a journey. I will say shout out to my son. His first card we got him last year was an Amex Green because they had the 60K bonus. And he redeemed points. He sent them to JetBlue to fly to Boston to see his girlfriend, redeeming his own points. I was so proud. It was like a baby bird leaving the nest. And then he just got his second credit card, and he actually went with a cashback card because we were talking about what do you see as the value of what you want? Do you think you're going to want to have more? And he's sitting on now like 50,000 points or something. He's like, I don't really see myself spending a lot of points anytime soon. So then we ended up getting the active cash card. So he had a good flat rate cash card. Traveling with kids, travel hacking, it's been a journey. And I mean that in some ways in a wonderful way. I mean, my kids we had an organized play date in Osaka where they spent the whole day with Japanese kids that were learning English. It was amazing.
Wow.
You know, they've seen Iguazu Falls. They've done some really amazing things.
I haven't seen Iguazu Falls.
I highly recommend. I recommend on the Argentina side. And do not stay at the Malia that used to be the Sheraton because monkeys poop on the balconies. So do not stay there.
Okay, no monkey feces. Okay.
But highly recommend. So they've had really some really cool experiences. The hacking side of it, the downside is in perspective. And having teaching them perspective was a constant. It's much better now because they have a more holistic view of everything. But through their childhoods, having the perspective to understand that not every hotel has a club. You know, like one of my kids had a meltdown in a Delta lounge because they only had apple juice and not grape and told me I needed to write the CEO of Delta. And at that point, I was like, oh, I failed you, honey. I failed you. We need to have a conversation about perspective. So, you know, there is definitely an ongoing conversation. And then there's also, for me, one of the things that happened is that my kids wanted to stay home after they turned maybe. It started 10, 11, 12, 13, 13, especially when they started like getting girlfriends or boyfriends or, you know, friend groups or activities. And so negotiating around those where maybe, you know, like, for instance, the last two Camp Moms we did, Aiden didn't stay the whole summer. He stayed part of it and he came back. Or the one I did 2 years ago, I brought three of his friends to, you know, they had four 19-year-old boys in Béziers. And the first time that the kids kind of didn't want to travel, it almost felt to me like a kick in the gut. You know, it felt like a rejection of my, I don't know, my religion or something. It felt like, you know, like, what, you know.
What's wrong with your value system?
Exactly, you know. But I had to understand that they can like something, but they don't have to obsess over it the way I do. You know, they have interests that I don't obsess over the way they do. And that's just part of being an individual. Then the other thing that the perspective comes in is realizing that you can't travel at the drop of a hat.
I wish some of my family members would learn that perspective. I have some family members that think, oh, we can't go tomorrow? You have points, right? They're free.
Yeah, well, we can't go, you know, like I had a conversation. There was one time there was a last minute fair sale to Hawaii. And I asked the kids if they wanted to go to Hawaii. And they're like, nah, we're good. We went last year. We're good. You know, or like one of the kids actually said to me once, one private island per year is enough for me. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they're still, you kept them.
Yeah. So, you know, that it's a perspective, you know, it's like making sure you're constantly having those conversations and saying, listen, we are living way above our pay grade here. You know, we are doing some amazing things. And like, I've had situations where friends of my kids, one of Aiden's friends came over like a year or so ago and was like, I thought your house would be bigger.
You know, they just had where do you think all that money is going, kid?
Yeah, exactly. They just had a different perspective of the perception of how we live. So, yeah. And then I had the double whammy of also getting things because of the blog or because of being a, you know, an influencer. So, like, the first time my kids had to wait online at Disney World. That was a no-go. Because they used to get these magic passes where we could just, you know, walk on things. And so that was, again, perspective. Listen, this is not a normal experience.
Right.
And now they understand that it was a gift. They see the positives.
Yep.
But it was definitely, there were definitely times where it felt like a journey.
So it's really interesting that you say that because perspective is such an important word in your answer. I had always thought that traveling gave you the perspective of how others lived and sort of broke down some barriers. But you've used perspective in ways that have just instantly given me nightmares and also a lot of food for thought.
Yes.
You know, as I'm raising my daughter and trying to give her the great experiences. Now, partially at this age, there are experiences that, I mean, I like comfort. I want to fly lay flat. She doesn't need it, but she's going to fly lay flat because we want to fly lay flat. Right. But when she gets older, I want to avoid getting into a situation where if we've got to rough it, you know, if we've got to fly Euro business and that middle seat, she's in it versus that being empty. You know, I want to avoid that grape juice meltdown.
I also was wondering about that word perspective. And you know, to me, another really important thing about that perspective is also not everything goes right. I'm assuming during all these camp moms, something went wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And you've had some travel meltdowns. I was on a trip recently with my nephew, and you know, we were flying to Florida, and we had an hour-long delay on a flight, and it was incredibly hot. You know, the plane was, you know, not the circulation was not good. And we were on there for like an hour waiting for, you know, whatever. And I think there's perspective also to know, hey, things will go wrong. You need to be patient, or you need to deal with life and understand that not everything's going to go your way all the time. Sometimes you are going to be uncomfortable. And I think seeing that perspective too, just by virtue of probably having the exposure of travel, I feel like a lot of people are missing that. You know, a lot of grown adults have not unfortunately had as much adversity, I think, as maybe they should have had, because they probably wouldn't be acting out as almost as children if they really understood, you know, hey, this is part of travel. You know, things are going to go wrong. You're going to get delayed. You're going to be hot on an airplane stuck with a bunch of people in a metal tube. And you know what? Everybody else is miserable too. So just suck it up. You know, some of that, you need a little bit of that life, that lived experience as well, I think. And I think you get that also by exposing them to the world as you have. So I feel that's another part of the perspective, hopefully, that is.
I would agree with that. And I would agree with it. And especially in cases like, I'm trying to think of examples like maybe where we're in a Airbnb and the air conditioner doesn't work as well as they think it should. So, you know, the room only gets down to 74, you know, and they're complaining about how hot it is. And, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people here don't have air conditioning. Be happy right. at 74 and not 94. So, yeah, there's definitely things like that. We've definitely missed flights. We've definitely had delays. And when we were in Asia, it was probably the single scariest moment I've had as a parent, because when Ari got sick, she had tonsillitis. We got her medicine, and then she was getting better. Yeah. And I was traveling solo with them. Yeah, but then we got to Hong Kong and I got sick. And I was there with a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old. Yeah. And I had a fever of like 103. And I woke up at 3:00 in the morning. And again, fortunately, at this point, I was happy. I was in the Hyatt. I was in the Hyatt Regency in Hong Kong.
Oh, geez.
And I promised the kids, because we went to Hong Kong Disneyland that Thursday, and this was like that Saturday night when I got sick. I promised the kids that we'd go to Hong Kong Disneyland again before we left, because we were leaving mm-hmm. on Monday. So I got a doctor to come to my room. Travel insurance, by the way, travel insurance, Allianz for the win. But they drugged me up. I was on antibiotics. I was on, you know, all sorts of different stuff. And I got the kids to Hong Kong Disneyland, and I like almost passed out.
Wow.
Disneyland, you know, and like having to get them back. And it was just me being like, okay, you know, I need to do this. I promised them I would. But yeah, being the solo parent and being sick. And then also in Hong Kong, I think they still do. You have to go through the fever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just to fly.
And so I just like, you know, popped as much ibuprofen as I possibly could to try to make sure I went under the thing to be able to get us home. And so they had to really kind of step up. They had to, one, be flexible with, you know, our plans weren't what they expected them to be. And then also they kind of had to take care of me. So they definitely have had to step up in ways that I don't think they would have had to had we stayed at home.
Real talk on the Travel Stories podcast. I mean, you know, not everything is the A sides. There are some B sides to travel. So Dia, any final thoughts on Camp Mom before we move on to a couple of different topics and close it out?
I guess the main thing I would say is that with the rise of remote work, I think it's more and more possible. I would really encourage people to think about how much they're paying to entertain their kids during the summer. And think about how they might be able to spend that in ways that are more effective for everybody. You know, obviously, it's a little different when you have a 5-year-old versus a 12-year-old. But if you have a 12-year-old, chances are that, you know, I was able to still work. I was able to write or do whatever around their schedules. And we still were able to have a great time. And I was staying in places where they could go to a park, or they had things that they could do where I could kind of like get a coffee and was set up my Wi-Fi and they could do their thing. So that's the main thing I would say, is that I think that it's easier now even than when it was when I started.
you were a trailblazer and somehow society just sort of caught up with you. I love it.
We now have the technology.
Yes,
we now have the technology. So another one that you were sort of a trailblazer on that I think you probably have an unconventional opinion at this point is Disney World. So you've written a book on Disney. I don't know how relevant it still is just because of how many things have changed just in the last year, let alone, you know, in the last 5 years. But what are your thoughts now on Disney World for travel hacking families?
It's really interesting because obviously I wrote the book in 2019 and then obviously COVID hit. And then come late 2021, early 2022, I went back for a week and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to update the book. So then I came home and by the time I'd finished the update, things had completely changed again. And then I went in March of 2023, spending another week down there doing research. And then things completely changed again. And then in the last month, they've completely changed again. But with this last trip, when I was there last March, I really spent some time stepping outside of myself and looking at the people that were there and looking at the experience that they were having. And I came to the conclusion that I don't necessarily recommend Disney World as a vacation destination anymore.
It's almost an indictment.
I love Disney. I think that they're are other options to get a Disney fix. I think if you're, and I actually have done, I did the math on this as sort of a thought experiment and now flying coach and valuing points at a penny a point, a family of four for like a spring break type vacation from New York could fly to Paris and spend a week in Paris and 3 days at Paris Disneyland for the same price as a week in Orlando at Disney.
Wow. I believe it.
There's another representation or another place for that word perspective.
Yeah.
It's sort of, if you look at the forest through the trees, you can have a much better experience by just thinking a little bit less conventionally.
And it's that whole, how do I want to feel? I want to feel Disney. Yeah. Do I need to necessarily feel Disney in Florida? No. If I were on the West Coast, the same math works for California, for Tokyo. In Tokyo, Disney is fantastic. You can get an annual pass to Paris Disneyland that is good for 180 days a year for 300 euro.
That's like less than 2 days at Disney, right? At Disney World?
Yeah, day and a half. Yeah, day and a half.
That's crazy.
I mean, I would say that there are other competitors too, right? Like, I feel like people keep talking about Universal, you know, and how they are at a moment now where for the longest time, they were just kind of like, you know, the Avis, you know, we're number two, but we try harder. But now, you know, Universal is really making a run for their money from Disney's perspective, where suddenly their parks are suddenly having attractions that are very much, very competitive. And in some cases, a much better value without some of the baggage that you get at Disney World. So even looking at the other parks,
you can also use points for Universal tickets much easier than you can use them for Disney tickets. You can use Chase points at 1.5 if the reserve card for Universal tickets, and you can even use them for Universal VIP tour. And yeah, I agree with you. Between Harry Potter and you've got Mario, and then if you want to get really creative, you've got the Asian Universal parks.
You've got Singapore
and Osaka. Don't call me. I think it's Osaka. So yeah, so you can even do that and save even more.
Yep. There's some in Mideast, right? Like in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Or even your local regional parks. You know, I took my nephew recently to Dutch Wonderland in Lancaster. Or Lancaster, as somebody corrected me, I believe you're supposed to say. Not Lancaster, it's Lancaster. And we had a wonderful time. It was 4th of July. He rode, I think, some of the rides like 10 times. It was crazy.
I think Hershey Park is vastly underrated.
Oh, yeah, Hershey is Park, fantastic.
Yeah, Hershey is amazing too. You know, depending on the age of your child or your family, you know, or the kids, there are a lot of other options. You know what? It's not Disney World. You know, come on. Mm-hmm. It's not. But is it still entertaining? Is it still something worth going to? I think there are lots of options out there. It doesn't have to be Disney World. And everybody should really make a sober assessment of the value you're getting and say there are alternatives out there and take a look. Don't always kind of just like where we started with this conversation, you know, don't just do the group thing. Do some critical thinking for yourself. Look at your options and understand the world is big and there are lots of things out there.
I love that you said that group thing because that gets us to, I think, the last topic that we want to cover.
What a good, what is that? Organic segue.
Yeah, what a great segue. So we don't typically cover the news on this podcast. We try to go a little bit more evergreen, more experiential. But Dia, I know you have a strong opinion. We've seen a couple of different devaluations. Most recently, we got news on a couple of quote-unquote devaluations from the Bilt card. The most notable, I think, was that you can only earn 2x or whatever the multiplier is up to 1,000 points on rent day. I have the card. I don't use it so much that I exceed that 1,000 points. It didn't really move my needle, but there were a lot of people that were really unhappy about it. A couple of people found that I think they also said starting, I guess, October, you can't get 2x on tax payments. I should have thought about tax payments, but I didn't. Apparently, I'm not doing as much critical thinking as I should be. But Dia, you had an interesting opinion on this. Can you share a little bit more?
Sure. I think sometimes that we lose perspective. Perspective. We talked a lot about perspective today. And specifically, we need these programs to succeed. If they don't succeed, they're going to close. And if that means that they're closing loopholes left, you know, every place, very nice. Occasionally, it's inconvenient for you. I get it. It stinks for you. But if it makes the program continue to function for the other 99% of us, I'm in the same boat as you. I might have thrown a little bit more on my card the first of every month. I certainly wasn't going over $1,000 to where it would have made a difference. Another example of this is Hotels.com recently folded into Expedia, and a lot of people were really, really upset about the program because in their minds, it went from 10x to 2x because you were earning these stamps where for every 10 stamps, you got a free hotel night. The problem is 90%+ of people never earned 10 stamps and were getting literally zero value from the program. So the greater good is that everyone is able to benefit and the program is able to succeed. And I actually prefer the program the way it is now because of Vrbo. You get points for Vrbo, and Airbnb isn't giving you points. So I find it to be a very valuable program because then you can go and redeem those points on Expedia for car rentals, or you can redeem them for like redeem points for tours. So you can redeem them all sorts of different ways. But I think that sometimes it's that whole preaching to the choir and kind of talking in a box thing. I think we get irrationally upset about things. And I understand that, you know, if you've lost your hack or your little hole, sure. But if the programs don't make money, they're going to shut down.
Yeah.
And if you are this, you know, if you 1% that are maxing out your $100,000 tax payment on your Bilt card is the thing that's causing the program to not be profitable, I understand why they closed the loophole. Right. The program needs to function for the other 99% of us. There are some times where I do feel that pain. Like I was talking with an executive at Bilt a couple of years ago, and they told me that the vast majority of people redeem for rent, which really made me cry a little because, yeah, exactly. It's like 0.55 cents or some ridiculous value. Because I was saying to this guy, listen, why can't this be higher? Because I know how much you're paying for these Hyatt points, and it's certainly not 0.55 cents. So I understand, I feel some of this pain, but I think that we kind of forget that these programs exist to make money for their shareholders. And if they don't succeed, then they're just not going to exist. And I'd much rather have a universe in which they are existing, and maybe I'm making 1% less than I was before, than a situation where they just all go away.
It's really about sustainability, right? It's almost like these things are ecosystems, right? And just like we have the environment in the real world, these things also need to have a level of sustainability. And interestingly enough, I feel like this kind of thought is not all that new in that I've heard this kind of line of rationale, even talking about things like manufactured spending and stuff that, hey, don't kill the ecosystem. Let this thing be sustainable. Don't kill it. And I'm hearing echoes of that now. And that was something that maybe someone would have said at FTU, you know, 10 years ago or something like that, when they're talking about, you know, vanilla reloads or something. So, you know, so it's not necessarily new, but it's good that you're bringing it up because I haven't heard it recently. That again, once again, the idea of these things are an ecosystem, there is a give and take, and they're ultimately there to make money. So, you know, if you don't set them up to be sustainable, they're going to go away and everybody will lose, you know, not just.
And also just think about. Think about everybody that doesn't travel to the volume that we do. I mean, especially with like a program like Expedia, they let you redeem a dollar if you want to. So people that even if they do a $100 hotel stay and they get $2 back, they can redeem that $2. Whereas some of these other programs, you get such a big minimum, you have to spend so much. Stay 60 nights to get free breakfast. The vast majority of people aren't reaping these benefits. And
we're staying very several weeks at the Rio.
You can do to kind of democratize things a little bit. I think that's to the good.
But I think the interesting piece here is the perspective, to use that word again. I think Richard Kerr on one blog or interview said 2% of people were getting more than 1,000 points in a month. So what they effectively did was they said, for those 2%, we're sorry, but we're going to devalue just you, effectively. Right. That 98%, we're still going to get some level of value. Again, I probably didn't get 1,000 points in more than maybe 1 month out of the last year.
That 2% is disproportionately represented. Yes.
No, absolutely. But in reality, I'll give you another example. Life Miles just devalued like heck. I mean, almost 50% or more, the Lufthansa first class redemption. I would rather them devalue these things in a targeted manner if people are overusing things, rather than to say the peanut butter spread, okay, we're raising everything 33%. Right. Because that hurts. I might not do an economy award, but that's going to hurt a disproportionate amount of people probably at the economy level than it is for the first class.
Right.
So I think we've had a lot of really great conversation. Really, really appreciate having you on. There's so many other topics we want to have you on for. I mean, you kind of hinted at travel insurance. You talked about IHG. We'd love to have you back to talk some of that. I don't want to put you on the spot now for committing.
Oh, I'll talk anytime. I'm always happy to talk your ear off.
Oh, love it. Love it. Okay. But before we go, can you just share with folks how they can find you?
Sure. And,
and where they can find your work?
The easiest way is on social. I'm at the Dia Adams, and that is pretty much the easiest way to find me. My work is featured on Fortune Recommends. So if you just go to Fortune Credit Cards, you'll find me. I'm the senior editor. I have my column. And then I also, like I said, we have contributors that write for us, but I think we have a very select group of contributors that I'm pretty proud of. So I'm happy with the content that we're putting out. Our content is definitely not 401 level content. It's really tailored toward the business executive or the person that's earning points that just wants to sort of learn basics as to how to spend. So, you know, our content might not be quite as relevant to a hobbyist, but I think it's great if you need a place to send people to learn how to figure things out. That's really what I'm trying to build.
Well, Dia, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for being our first on our attempt at bringing video to YouTube. And like I said, you're welcome anytime.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Love talking to you anytime. It's been a true pleasure. And I think we've exchanged a lot of great conversation.
Absolutely.
Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member to get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.